You're listening to the Tipton Children Podcast.
Let's start with our motivation. Again, thinking of Mother sentient beings who've been kind to us and how their minds are overwhelmed by afflictions. And so even though they want happiness and not suffering, they can take great delight in doing foolish things that create the causes of suffering. So let's have a determination ourselves not to engage in such behavior, even if we, or even when we encounter people who are acting in spiteful or foolish ways. Restrain ourselves from retaliating, keeping an even mind, approaching them with compassion that sees the big picture, and that big picture is that our real enemies are the afflictions. So we want to have a strong determination to remove them from the root, our own mind stream, to attain full awakening, so we'll be able to be most effective in guiding others to remove their afflictions. And so with this kind of motivation, then we will seek to realize emptiness. First conceptually, then directly, because it's the wisdom realizing emptiness that is the real antidote to the afflictions, as well as to the cognitive obscurations, the latencies of the afflictions that stain the mind. So for that reason, we'll listen and learn about emptiness this evening. I just want to read last week, the verse we did last week, and also, somebody wrote in a question that I will answer in conjunction with that. Okay, so the verse is, the person is not earth, not water, not fire, not wind, not space, not consciousness, not all of them together. What person is there other than these? Okay, so this is analyzing the relationship of the person with the basis of designation of the person, in this case the six constituents. Usually we say the basis of designation of the person is the five aggregates. These six constituents come to the same point because the five elements, earth, water, fire, air, and space, are the aggregate of form, and then the six constituent consciousness includes the four mental consciousnesses. Okay? So here we're analyzing the relationship of the person with the basis of designation of the person, saying that if the person were inherently existent, then it would have to be either one with or completely separate from its basis of designation. Now normally, in just regular conventional existence, it's not required that the designated object and the basis of designation be inherently identical or inherently different. But when we're thinking that things are inherently existent, then they have to be like that, right? Because inherent existence means independent existence, that things are their own self-enclosed entity. They don't relate to anything. They aren't affected by anything else. Okay? So then we go about analyzing how the person exists in relationship to the aggregates. Okay? And we'll get into that a little bit later. Okay? Now, someone wrote the question here. Okay? So this person said, you know, in the meditation on emptiness, the four-point analysis, you know, where the first point is identifying the object of negation, then second point, understanding that if things were inherently existent, they would have to either be inherently one or inherently separate. Third point, they're not inherently one. Fourth point, they're not inherently different. Conclusion, therefore, they're empty of inherent existence. Okay? So, this person is saying, we talked about the meditation on emptiness. It seems like the conclusion explicitly would be dependent arising. The I exists merely by nominal designation, and only implicitly would one conclude emptiness. Earlier made a comment about refuting an inherently existent object implicitly posits the existence of a nominal object, and it seems like that's the focus of this meditation. She has clarified that we're not looking for an inherently existent I, but rather looking to see what the manner of existence of the I is. Okay. So that's the question. There's a bit of confusion here. Yeah. So the thing about explicit and implicit is when you negate inherent existence, you are implying that things are dependent arising. Because if things aren't inherently existent, yeah, they still have to exist in some way, because inherent existence is not total non-existence. So they still have to exist in some way. How do they exist? They must exist dependently, because they don't exist independently. So that's where the implicit comes in. Okay? However, yeah, when you're meditating on emptiness, okay? So, remember the other day we said we start out with wrong view, then we don't go to doubt, to correct assumption, yeah? So when you're at correct assumption and you're meditating and doing these, meditating on these logical reasons, reasonings, then you get a correct inference. So you meditate on the different points, and the points show you that things do not inherently exist, okay? So there's any number of reasonings we can use to meditate on emptiness. In the case of this four-point analysis, you know, the third point, well, the second point is, you know, they would have to be inherently one or inherently separate. Third point, they aren't inherently one. Fourth point, they aren't inherently separate. At that point, you still haven't reached the conclusion. After that, you have to go. If, because they're not inherently one, and because they're not inherently separate, therefore, they are empty of inherent existence. You still have to draw that conclusion at the end. Then you stay, if somebody's, let's say, on the path of accumulation or path of preparation, or even an ordinary being, you know, has some strong concentration, they stay in that conclusion of, you know, therefore the person does not exist inherently. And so the object of their meditation that they apprehend at that point is emptiness, the emptiness of inherent existence. Emptiness is the object that is the appearing object to that mind and the apprehended object. Actually, in the case of an inference, the mental image of emptiness is the appearing object, but emptiness is the apprehended object. And so only that is appearing to the mind. Dependent arising is not appearing to the mind. The object that you were analyzing to see if it was truly existent or not does not appear to that mind. Okay, so you can't say that the explicit conclusion would be dependent arising. That's not the case. It's only emptiness. When you have a direct realization of emptiness, only emptiness is the appearing object. Only emptiness is the apprehended object. And the basis of designation does not appear. Because remember, when we say non-dual, yeah, there's a few different meanings of non-dual. One is there's no feeling of subject and object. The other is there's no appearance of conventional phenomena. So the basis of designation that is a conventional phenomena, the person, the table, whatever it is, does not appear to that mind. Yeah. And there's no appearance of inherent existence. So you are not apprehending dependent arising at that time. You are apprehending only emptiness. Okay. When somebody comes out of that meditative state, you know, in that the meditative state is called meditative equipoise on emptiness. When you come out of that, that's called subsequent attainment. And during that time, somebody may do their regular activities, you know, cleaning the house, cooking food. They may meditate on other subjects. They may study. You know, they can do other Dharma activities, prostrations, mandala offerings, whatever. During that time, when conventional objects again appear to that person, at the time that there's still kind of like a hangover from when you realized emptiness. They don't use that term. They say when it's a mind that is still under the influence of having realized emptiness, you know, when it's a mind informed by that realization. But what it means is it's kind of like a hangover because you realized emptiness. You came out of that, but the whole feeling of having realized emptiness is there, is still there, and it's still affecting your mind, even though now your senses are operating. At that time, things will appear to you as being like an illusion. Okay? They are not an illusion. Yeah, because things that are illusion, you know, don't really exist. But they are like an illusion in that they still appear truly existent, but they are not truly existent. So they have a false appearance. That's the meaning of like an illusion. Okay? So like an illusion doesn't mean that you see, you know, things made of light flowing in and out of your life and magical horses and things appearing and disappearing, and you know, it doesn't mean that. It means simply that things do, that you recognize that although things are still appearing truly existent, they don't exist that way. So they're false. They're like an illusion because they don't exist the way they appear. So that kind of appearance comes in the subsequent attainment time. And that's when you reflect on dependent arising. And that's when you see that things, you really come to understand dependent arising very deeply. Before, you may still use dependent arising, you know, before you realize emptiness. You know, for example, the self does not inherently exist because it's a dependent arising. Yeah. So you still may use, let's say, causal dependent dependence because the self depends on causes and conditions, or because the self depends on parts. So you may still use a reasoning of dependent arising. But once you get a good understanding of dependency, you know, at the beginning of your meditation, then your object, you realize because it's dependent, therefore it must be empty. And then your object is emptiness. It's not dependent arising. Okay, because the syllogism is, you know, the self is empty because it depends on causes and conditions. So you see how it depends on causes and conditions. That's the first part of the syllogism, you know, that the reason applies to the subject. Then you realize the privation of the syllogism. If it's dependently arising, therefore it's empty. At that point, you realize emptiness, and emptiness is what you're perceiving. You are no longer perceiving causal dependence or thinking about causal dependence, because your object is emptiness. Okay. Then when you come out of your meditation on emptiness and you're seeing things again, then they appear like illusions. And at that time, you again contemplate dependency, and you really begin to see the dependency in a much deeper way because of having realized emptiness. And that's the time when you really get a deeper feeling for things being dependent on concept and term. But, you know, going deeper into things being dependent on concept and terms happens after you emerge from the meditative equipoise on emptiness. Okay? Yeah, so is that clear now?
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you're meditating on emptiness, you may be searching, you know, to see if the person is one with or same from the aggregates. You do not find the person as one or same with the aggregates. But the aggregates are not appearing to you when you focus on emptiness. It's not like you're appearing the aggregates are there and you know emptiness implicitly. That's what the Satantrikas say. Yeah, but you act, but according to the Prasangikas, you perceive emptiness. You are only perceiving a non-affirming negation. You're not perceiving the aggregates. Yeah, because you can't, you know, have the appearance of the aggregates and the appearance of the emptiness of the aggregates at the same time. Because all of the consciousnesses except the meditative equipoise directly perceiving emptiness. In ordinary beings, all the other consciousnesses are mistaken because inherent existence appears to them. They don't necessarily grasp at it, but it appears. So you can't have the appearance of an inherently existent object when you're in direct realization of emptiness. Okay? So you see how we're always trying to find some way to hang on to something. Yeah. Well, the aggregates must still be there, and I'm just seeing there's no person inside the aggregates. No, because the aggregates are also empty. Otherwise, you know, and this is the problem with the Sautantrikas. the lower school, is that they assert that the phenomena, that they say the person is empty of a self-sufficient, substantial existent person, but phenomena like the aggregates are truly existent. So that's why they say, yeah, you're meditating on emptiness, but you perceive the aggregates. The Prasangikas say, you know, if you're perceiving the aggregates as inherently existent, then you're going to be perceiving the person as inherently existent also. Because they're one nature and the person depends on the aggregates. Yeah. So you can't perceive one as empty and the other as inherently existent. Okay? So you've got to be really clear on that. When you're meditating on emptiness, yeah, your apprehended object is only emptiness. Yeah. It's not an inherently existent person, and then you're seeing it really doesn't exist. Because that would be a wrong consciousness. If you're perceiving an inherently existent person, that's a wrong consciousness. Okay? So, when I said we're not looking for an inherently existent I, we're examining how the I exists. We're examining it by saying, if the I were inherently existent, it would be like X, Y, and Z. So that's how we're examining to see how the I exists. We're seeing, oh, if the I existed inherently, it would be either one or separate from the aggregates. If it's one with the aggregates, then you have the problem of, since there's one I, you should only have one aggregate. Or since there's five aggregates, there should be five people. Okay? So you're examining how the I exists. You're not looking for the inherently existent. But in examining how the I exists, you're seeing that it can be inherently one with the aggregates or inherently separate. Okay. So the person who wrote this question, if it isn't clear, write another question. And I'll probably say the same thing again. Yes?
Also, I have a question. I might have misunderstood it in the last teaching. I say, when refuting inherently existent object, we implicitly posit an object that exists by mere conceptualization. Because if we don't posit that, then when we would realize emptiness, we would fall into nihilism and think that nothing whatsoever existed. So I was confused about the realization of emptiness and falling into nihilism.
Okay, the idea is, like I said, when you perceive emptiness, you only perceive emptiness. Mm-hmm. When you come out of that, if you think there's no self, there's no table, then that's nihilism. Okay? So, if you just come out of emptiness and you say, there's no self, there's no table, there's no carpet, there's nothing, then you've gone to the extreme of nihilism.
I only thought that this will not happen after realizing emptiness, that you fall into this extreme. I thought that's before you realize emptiness.
When we say realize emptiness, there's the conceptual realization and the direct realization. So this kind of problem doesn't happen after the direct one. It could happen, you know, when you're still, I don't know if it would be after the conceptual one, or it could be while you're analyzing before you've had the conceptual one. I think it's more when you're analyzing before you have the conceptual realization that then you go, oh, you know, nothing exists.
So you haven't really realized emptiness, you've just kind of gone, right, the absence of everything.
Yeah. You haven't realized emptiness. If you come to a nihilistic conclusion, you haven't realized emptiness.
Your absence has gone too far.
Yeah. Yeah, so you don't have the view of the middle way. So when we talk of the view of the middle way, sometimes we think, okay, there's absolutism, here, nihilism here, true existence here, total non-existence here. We add them together and divide in two, and that's the middle way. So, you know, because that's the way we usually find the middle. You know, you average them. Yeah, so it's somewhere between those two. Actually, emptiness and true dependent arising have nothing to do with either of those extremes. They're not the, it's not the average middle way. It's not the middle between those two. It has nothing to do with either of those, because things are not empty and they're not non-existent. Okay? Yeah?
The post-meditative buzz from having some equanimity focused on emptiness, is that a virtuous form of jhigpa?
Say that again? You mean like...
Under the influence... After the meditative state, where you perceive emptiness, and
maybe you're meditating on bodhicitta at that time. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm asking that hangover you were talking about.
Yeah.
Is that a virtuous form of jhigpa?
Oh, is that a virtuous form of jhigpa?
Is that the explanation for why you're feeling that?
Yeah. Let me think just a second. Having happened of that wisdom. I don't think so. No, I don't think so. Yeah.
When we're meditating so on emptiness, and we establish the object of negation, and then we go through those four stages. Mm-hmm. And then you say we want to reach the conclusion of emptiness, and then that's the object. Mm-hmm. So, how do we get to direct? I mean, it just seems so intellectual. What's that taste of?
That's what they say you can't describe in words.
Okay,
you've got to experience. I'll think some more about your question. Yeah, they often give the analogy of perceiving emptiness as being like perceiving space, okay? Because both of them are non-affirming negatives in the sense that neither one of them are positing some positive object to perceive. However, perceiving space and perceiving emptiness are different. Okay, let's go on here. Unless we have something important. Okay, so let's go on to verse 81. Okay, so verse 80 was talking about the selflessness of persons. You know how the person isn't any of the constituents. Now verse 81. Is talking about the selflessness. It's bringing us into the selflessness of phenomena. So it says, just as the person is not real due to being a composite of six constituents, so each constituent also is not real due to being a composite. Okay? So just as the person isn't real, meaning truly existent, because it is dependent on the six constituents. It is merely designated in dependence on the composite of the six constituents. Okay, here it says due to being a composite. It's more due to being designated in dependence on the composite of the six constituents. Okay, so that's how the person exists, dependent, you know, in that way. That's why the person isn't truly existent. So too, each of the constituents is not truly existent because it depends on, it too is a composite of parts, okay? So the thing about something being a composite of parts is the parts are not the object, yeah? So if you have a car, you may have a lot of car parts, but none of the parts are the car. Yeah? Because, you know, is the wheel the car? Is the engine the car? Is the axle the car? You go through all the parts. None of them are the car. Yeah? Then it's very tempting to say, well, the composite, the collection of the parts, is the car. You put all those parts together, and voila, you have a car. So it's very tempting to think that the collection is the car. If that were the case, then each of the parts is a non-car, right? If you put together a lot of things that are non-cars, will you have a car? No. It's like putting together a bunch of oranges and having an apple. You can't put a group of non-persons put together are not going to be a person. The person is designated in dependence upon the composite of non-persons, but is not the composite of non-persons. Okay? Yeah? So you see again, our mind is like, I'm going to find something real there anyway, you know? And we're going to come to it because we negate all sorts of different relationships between the person and the aggregates. And, you know, oh yeah, the collection isn't the person. But if, you know, because then you say, well, if you just put all the car parts there in a heap, you don't have a car. You have a junkyard. Then somebody says, if you arrange all the car parts in a certain way, then you have a car. That one's really seductive. The arrangement of all the car parts in a certain manner is the car. But again, you still have the same problem. It doesn't matter how much you arrange a bunch of things that are not cars, how are you going to come up with a car? So it points out to us that there's some flaw in our perception. Okay? When I'm seeing this, I see one thing. I don't see this as a collection of parts. Yet, it's a collection of parts, isn't it? I see it as one thing, and I know it's a thermos, so it seems like it has thermos nature all through. This whole thing has thermos nature. But that's a problem. If I look at it like that, that's a problem because this isn't one thing. If I go like this, which one is the thermos? Now we definitely have two things, don't we? Which one is the thermos? If somebody says, please give me the thermos, and you give them that, are they going to be happy?
What's the lid?
If you give them this, are they going to be happy? If this cannot function as a thermos, it can't keep things hot. There's no top on it. This alone is not a thermos.
It's a cup.
thermos, and that's not a thermos, but that is a thermos. We say is a thermos as if it has some entity in it that's radiating the essence of thermosness. Yeah. But there's actually nothing there in it that's a thermos, because like this, it's very clear there's no thermos. So we want to, you know, make everything have some kind of essence. Okay. So, with verse 81, where we're looking, you know, again, yeah, the person's not real because it's dependent on a composite. So each of the parts also isn't truly existent because it too is a composite. Okay? So anything that exists inherently should be findable either in its basic of designation or separate from it. You know, we keep hearing this again and again and again, you know, for the reason that we don't really get it. But the person's not any of the six constituents, and it can't be found. The person is not found in any of the six, in the collection of the six constituents. Okay, so you have earth, water, fire, air, space, consciousness. None of them is a person. You put them all together here, and we say there's a person. Where did that person come from? What is that person that now appears when you put the six constituents together? What in the world is it? Because it's not any of the six constituents separately. It's a bunch of non-persons, but you put them all together in a certain way and you say, there's children, or there's, you know, whoever you're talking about. But who in the world is that person? Can you find a person there? Yeah? You can't find a person there. There's nobody home. And yet, we feel like, by golly, there's a person with this kind of personality who exists in such and such a relationship with me, and they're very predictable, and I know who they are. And what are you going to point to as being that person? Are you going to point to the earth element? The solidity in their body, is that the person? Is the water in their body the person? The fire? The wind? The space? The consciousness? Oh, maybe the consciousness is the person. Which consciousness? The wide awake consciousness, the sleeping consciousness. The consciousness that's under the influence of an affliction, the consciousness that isn't. The happy consciousness, the unhappy consciousness. What consciousness are you going to say is the person? So it's kind of like magic, you know, how things appear. Yeah, they seem so solid and real. But when you do this kind of analysis, it's kind of like things, they kind of come out of nowhere. Yeah, you have a bunch of things that are not a plant, and you put them together and you get a plant. Isn't that like magic? Just sit with it for a little bit. Think about it. Okay. So you can find some person there, and yet we can't say the person is totally non-existent. Because if somebody says, where's Chodron? You say, she's sitting over there. And we all agree on that. Yeah. And nobody goes, what Chodron, you know? So on the conventional level, you know, where is the person? Sitting on the chair. Yeah. There's a person sitting on the chair. There is no person in the aggregates. Yeah. There's a person on the chair. There's no person in the aggregates. How can there be a person on the chair if there's no person in the aggregates? There's got to be somebody there. Otherwise, how could somebody be sitting on the chair? But then you go, well, if there's somebody sitting on the chair, tell me who it is, what it is. What are you going to point to as being the person? Can't point to anything. Okay? So the person is not non-existent. Because it depends on the composite of the six constituents. And it depends on the mind that conceives and gives it a designation. Okay? So something that exists by being merely designated by conception cannot inherently exist. Those two things are contradictory. Being inherently existent and existent dependent on being designated by conception. Yeah, something cannot be both of those. But when we say, how do things exist, there's only two choices. Either they exist inherently, or they exist by being designated by conception. Yeah. So if it isn't one, it's got to be the other. So something that exists by being merely designated by conception cannot exist inherently, because inherently existent things would have their own independent essence. And something that exists by being merely designated by conception doesn't have its own essence because it's designated by conception. If something had its own essence, we wouldn't need to designate it. We would already know that that's what it is. And that's why, you know, when we look at this, we say there's a thermos. You know, we don't think, well, thermos is just the name designated on this object. We think, oh, there's a thermos in there. And so that's why we say that inherent existence appears to our senses, and then so easily we grasp that inherent existence, we assent to that appearance. Okay? Good. I mean, does this appear to you as if it's designated by conception?
No.
No. Of course not. We look at this and say this is a thermos, whether I call it a thermos or not. Or we think this is a thermos, whether we all agree that it functions as we've assigned the definition of the sound thermos to mean. Yeah, not either of those, okay? So having refuted the inherent existence of the person, lest we then think that the constituent parts of the person exist inherently, then Nagarjuna now turns to saying, no, not even the constituents inherently exist. Okay, so he uses the same reasoning to disprove the inherent existence of the constituents that he used in proving the non-inherent existence of the person. Okay. So just as the person exists by being merely designated independence on its designation, the six constituents, all, so does each constituent, exist by being merely designated independence on its collection of parts. Just as the person, yeah, is empty of inherent existence because it is neither one nor separate from its basis of designation, so too are each of the parts of the person not inherently existent because they're dependent on their basis of the collection of parts of their basis of designation. Okay? Or because they're not, so too each of the parts isn't inherently existent because it's neither one nor separate from the things that compose it, from its basis of designation. Okay? So the earth element doesn't exist inherently because it arises depending on the collection of its parts. Yet the earth element cannot be found in any of the parts individually, nor can it be found separate from the parts. So you see the same kind of reasoning. Yeah. So this reasoning of not being identical or separate, of not being one or many, in relationship to the parts, can be used for any object when we're analyzing how it exists. Okay. Now, verse 82, we're going to get into a little bit more here, the selflessness of the person. This gets really kind of juicy in here. Okay, so the verse reads, the aggregates are not the self, yeah, nor do they exist in the self, nor is the self in the aggregates. But without them, the self cannot exist. And the self and aggregates are not mixed like fire and fuel. Therefore, how could the self exist? Okay, so here when we're talking about self, we're referring to the person. Sometimes when we use the word self, it means inherent existence. Like when we say self-grasping or selflessness of person, something like that. Okay, so here we're analyzing the relationship between the person and the aggregates. And Nagarjuna also does this in chapter 2 of his seminal treatise on the Middle Way, where he examines how the Tathagata exists. So it's very skillful how he examines how the Tathagata exists, because people really grasp at the Buddha as inherently existent. There's an inherently existent Tathagata. And then Nagarjuna goes, whoop! Can't find it. Yeah. Okay. So, the self that is being negated is the conceived object and the apprehended object of the self-grasping. Here, self-grasping. Here, self means inherent existence when we talk about self-grasping. Okay? So the self that is negated, yeah, is the conceived object and the apprehended object of the self-grasping. Yeah? So the self-grasping ignorance, yeah, it's a conceptual mind. But it's not conceptual like we're thinking in words and thoughts. It's a much subtler kind of conception. Yeah. So it's not a directly perceiving mind. Yeah, that's the point. Yeah, when we say conceptual, don't think thinking in gross thoughts. It basically means it's not a direct perceiver. Yeah. So it's the conceived object. The self-grasping ignorance, the object that's being conceived, is an inherently existent person. And the object that's being apprehended is an inherently existent person. You know, what's being apprehended is an inherently existent person. However, that inherently existent person does not exist. And that's why self-grasping is an erroneous consciousness. Because You know, what it thinks, what it's conceiving, what it's apprehending does not exist. Yeah. So actually, you know, when we're angry, when we're filled with attachment or some strong emotion or whatever, we are not perceiving reality. Because we're grasping at whatever object our emotion is towards as having its own essence inherently there. Yeah. But boy, when we're angry, we don't think, I'm not perceiving reality. Yeah. We're very sure we're perceiving reality in many different ways. Not only that the person we're mad at is inherently existent, but also we're sure that the way we're perceiving them is the correct way. That they really are a jerk from their own side. Yeah. Permanently, always, irredeemably. Yeah. Everybody else would agree with us. Yeah. So forever and ever that person is a jerk. Yeah. That's the way we perceive them, right? When you're mad at somebody. Yeah, thoroughly, inside out, every molecule of them, you know, is a jerk. And our perception of them as a jerk is a correct perceiver. And anybody who likes this guy has a wrong consciousness. Because my perception is right, my conception is right, okay?
That we're all kind of laughing because we're familiar with this. Mm-hmm. So we can watch our mind in retrospect do that, and we can see what we were seeing and see how off base it was. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, is that the same process that we need to be able to recognize in order to bring up the object of negation?
Yeah, it's very similar in the sense that when we're angry, we start with recognizing that our mind is, you know, exaggerating the negativity of the person. That already is a big stretch for us, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah,
in the moment, it's a very big stretch. So similarly, realizing that that person is not an inherently existent person is even a bigger stretch for us. Okay, but the whole idea is to begin to question what we are cognizing. Instead of taking all of our cognitions as being the truth, to be able to question them and check them. Do things exist the way I am apprehending them as existing? Do they exist as they even appear to my sense consciousness? Okay. So, if the person inherently existed, it would have to exist in one of those five ways in relationship to the aggregates that are its basis of designation. So let's go through those five ways, okay? So the aggregates are not the self. That's one thing being negated. They don't exist in the self, in the person. Third, nor is the person in the aggregates. Fourth, without the aggregates, the self can't exist. And fifth, the self and the aggregates are not mixed together like fire and fuel. So if there were an inherently existent person, we should be able to, when we examine, you know, how a person exists, we should be able to find that the aggregates are the self, or the aggregates are in the self, or the self is in the aggregates, or the self can exist without the aggregates, or that the self and the aggregates are mixed. We should be able to find them in one of those ways. And yet this verse is saying five no's. Okay? The, what is it? That the the caucus of no's? Yeah? So here, this is what Congress should be saying no to. Yeah? So, you know, aren't they the Congress of no or the caucus of no? Yeah? So it should be no, the aggregates are not the self. No, the self isn't the aggregates. No, the aggregates are to the self. Yeah? That's what they should all be saying. Okay. Yeah, since they enjoy saying no so much. True, isn't it? Yeah? Shall we go tell them that? Okay, so let's look at the first one. The aggregates are not the self. So the person and the aggregates are not the same entity or nature, but put it this way. The aggregates and the person are the same entity or nature, but they aren't inherently the same entity or nature. Okay? Why are they the same nature? Because when you have the aggregates, you have the person. I mean, the two can't exist without both of them being there. But they aren't inherently in one entity or one nature, because if they were, they would be exactly the same in all aspects. Okay? So they would have, if they were inherently the same entity, they would have to be identical. Okay? So then they would, the I and the aggregates would have to be inseparably one in every single way. So that's what we get. If there's one aggregate, if there's one I, one person, there must be one aggregate. And if there's five aggregates, there must be five people, because they would have to be identical in every single way. Okay? So in general, when we're talking just conventionally, when something is the same entity or the same nature as another thing, those two things don't have to be inseparably one or without any difference whatsoever. But if we talk about two things being inherently one entity, then they have to be either totally identical in all aspects or totally unrelated and separate. Okay? So when we're doing this thing about the number, you know, then someone could say, well, there's many persons, because there's the person of the past life, the person of the present life, the person of the future life. So there are many people. Yeah, so the self can be, you know, can be inherently existing. But this analysis is just looking at one particular moment, you know. So when you're looking at the aggregates that exist right now, we're analyzing them, not in relationship to the past and the future and things like that. Okay? So are there five persons at this moment because there's five aggregates? Or is there one aggregate at this moment because there's one person? Okay. Then this, another reason, and this one I think is a very good reason. If the self and the aggregates were inherently one and the same, then asserting the existence of the person would be totally useless, because the person is exactly the same as one of the aggregates. So if we say the aggregate is the same thing as the body, then we don't even need to assert the existence of a person, because the word body would also refer to the person, because they're one and the same thing. Okay? So you might say, well, the body is walking across the room. That might work. But then you would also have to say, the body is thinking. Because every time you used to use the word I, you could substitute it now for the body, because they're the exact same thing. Okay? So the body is thinking. The body is taking an SAT test. Yeah? the body is lonely. Yeah. The body is planning something. This sounds pretty ridiculous, doesn't it? The body can't do those things. So then you say, okay, well, maybe not, the person's not the exact same thing as their body. Maybe they're the exact same thing as their mind. Then if that's the case, then still you don't need the word I, because the word mind would fit in every case where we normally use the word I. So then you have the mind is playing basketball. Yeah. Yeah, you have the Olympics going on, and the minds are all they're racing in the swimming. The minds are having a race in the swimming pool. Yeah. So again, that's pretty ridiculous. So we see, but I think that's a really good reason. If they were exactly the same, because sometimes we may feel, oh, I am my body, or I am my mind. You know, when you feel like that, well, if I am my body, then everything, I say I would do it, the body would do. Or if I'm my mind, everything I say I'm doing, my mind would be doing. And then you can see it. You get all these ridiculous kinds of consequences. Okay. So if the self and the aggregates were inherently one and the same, we couldn't remember events from the past. Okay? And I'll go into this in a minute. In addition, the karma we created in the past would get lost. We wouldn't experience it. And we could experience the results of karma we didn't create. Okay, so why do you get these three consequences? So just as the aggregates arise and cease inherently, okay, if the person is one with them, then the person would also arise and cease inherently. Okay? So something that arises and ceases inherently cannot be part of a continuum. Because remember, inherently existent things are independent of everything else. They can't be part of a continuum, because in a continuum, one moment of a continuum is dependent on the previous moment of the continuum, and it also gives rise to the next moment of the continuum. Okay, so something that is inherently existent, it can't be part of a continuum, so when it ceases, it's gone forever. Okay, so in that case, each moment of a person would be a separate person that is unrelated to the previous moment of the person and the subsequent moment of the person. Okay? It would be a totally different person. Sometimes people, when you talk about rebirth, they'll say, well, the previous person I was isn't me. They're a totally different person. Not exactly. If they were a totally different person, you wouldn't be able to experience the result of the actions they did. Because you would be two separate people, like you and Henry Kissinger are two separate people. Yeah? Or you and Lady Gaga are two separate people. Okay? Okay, so something that's inherent, Yeah, so we got, so each moment of the person would be a separate person, unrelated to the previous or the subsequent moments of the person. If the person of each moment of our continuum were inherently separate from all the other moments, then we could not remember what we did in the past. Because who we are today would be an entirely different person than who we were yesterday. So we could not remember what the person of yesterday did, because we would be an entirely different person. Yeah. Also, the person of yesterday who did certain karmic actions, their actions would get lost because they would become completely non-existent when they ceased. So they would do all this, create all these actions, and their actions would have no result because they ceased. Okay? Or you could say, you know, when the person of yesterday ceases and it's a totally different person of today that arises, then the actions the person did of yesterday created, the results of those actions could not be experienced by the person of today, because they're two separate people. Okay? So the person who passed who took the SAT test yesterday could not be the person who passed. It would be an entirely different person than the person who passed the SAT test today. Yeah. Which would mean that you would be forever taking SAT tests because you could never pass them. Okay? Yeah. In addition, you know, if you said, well, today's person could still experience the result of the actions yesterday's person did, even though yesterday's person was a totally different person, then today's person could equally experience the reactions, the result of the actions that Lady Gaga did yesterday, because she's equally a totally different person from the person we were yesterday. Okay? So then you get these crazy things, you know. You can't remember from one day to the next, and it's not just due to old age this time. It's due to inherent existence. You know? What you do yesterday, you know, what you did yesterday would have no effect on what you did today. Yeah? So getting a good night's sleep last night would not make you feel well rested this morning, because you would be two different people. Yeah? Or if you still say that today's person can, you know, experience the result of what yesterday's person did, since yesterday's person is an entirely different person than who you are today, then, you know, Henry Kissinger, John Boehner, you know, Saddam Hussein, Hillary Clinton, you could experience the results of their karma too, because they are equally totally different persons. So you see, it all becomes nonsense. Yeah. When you try and look, yeah, with reasoning and examine, is it possible for something to exist inherently? All you come up with is these crazy kind of consequences that can't possibly exist. Okay, so you just have to assume from that there's no inherent existence. Yeah, because there's no way to say things inherently exist and still have stuff make sense. Everything just becomes stupidaggio. Okay? So, we'll stop here. Yeah.
Okay. When I have strong reaction like anger, attachment, you say I'm not perceiving the reality as it is. When I have strong anger or attachment, I'm not
seeing reality
as it is. What is the difference of now listening to your teachings?
What is the difference of what?
Now I'm listening to your
teachings.
My heart just opens.
Uh-huh.
But I'm not perceiving reality. What is it?
Yeah.
Is it because it's virtuous? It's not virtuous like that?
Yeah. Well, when you listen to teachings and then your mind is saying, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense. Then you're going towards. You're no longer stuck in wrong consciousnesses. Now you're into correct assumptions. Assumptions, and you're going, oh yeah, I can kind of follow that reasoning. That makes sense. And then, of course, inside you feel completely differently. Yeah? Because when you're sitting there, when you're angry and it's like, this guy is an inherently existent jerk and I'm inherently existent, right? You know? The mind. Yeah. The guy, you know, the mind is very unhappy at that moment. Yeah. When you think, oh yeah, I'm listening to a Dharma teaching, that's kind of making sense. I'm getting it. Yeah, your mind is more open, it's happier. And that in itself proves that you aren't inherently existent. Because if you were inherently existent, your attitudes, your moods could never change.
So I don't have that much trouble looking at the thermos, taking all the pieces apart mentally, grasping that there is no thermos, or that the thermos isn't independently existent, but then somehow trying to make that leap from the thermos to a person. I'm sure I'm not the only person in the room who is struggling with that.
Yes.
Is there something that kind of helps us pass that point of inanimate?
Well, I think the thing that makes it easy with the thermos is right now you're not terribly attached to the thermos. Yeah. Whereas a person, when you try and jump to a person, there's much more attachment there. Yeah, there's much more belief in our conception of who they are. Yeah. If you had some attachment to the thermos, it might be, you know, also very difficult. Like if you take, like some, is there some heirloom in your family that's been passed down?
My mother's Steuben glass cap.
Okay, so the Steuben
is a glass-making company.
Yeah, so it's a glass cap, okay, that's been in the family for generations, yeah? Okay, so if that cap got broken, would you have some feelings about it?
Yeah.
Yeah, you'd have some feelings about it, yeah? So that's because there's some attachment. Now if you start to look at, you know, what is that glass cat? Yeah, what is it?
It's nothing. No, it's not nothing. It's nihilism, right? But
it's just a lump of glass.
It's
isn't
muted
it?
Things.
Yeah. And where is there inside it? You know, because you're seeing this lump of grass, you know, oh, the and imputing, you know, the glass, the cat that's been in the family for so long and very meaningful, and it contains like the essence of all the family's love and the memories of all of our ancestors, and you know, can you see how the mind's imputing so much stuff on it? And that's exactly why when there's an estate sale, you know, people put the prices of junk way high because for them it's like this is a precious thing that's been in the family. And for another person, they come by and say, oh, why are you charging $25 for this piece of junk? You know, because they don't have the same imputation on the object.
So are there meditations or things to do to kind of help that transition from the inanimate object to the self?
We'll start with the cat.
Okay.
And then go to a person. When you can get it, it's like, there's nothing in that cat. Then, you know, then go to a person who you're not so attached to and see if you can kind of deconstruct them. Okay? Gradually move on. Yeah?
Before when I'm angry or when emotions come, I feel that the awareness of breathing actually helps me to perceive reality clearer. Why is it so?
Well, actually, awareness of breathing calms your mind. If you can then move your mind to, you know, asking yourself what's the conventional reality, or, you know, then that's helped. The breathing itself isn't the antidote. The breathing calms the mind, and then you can look at the situation clearer. Yeah?
Regarding the person or phenomena, it's easy to say, oh, I get it with person or not phenomena, but I think on the level we need to get it, we're not getting at either of these levels.
Yeah. We're understanding the argument on an intellectual level, but it's not impacting us. Yeah. So there's a difference between those two.
Drastic.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. One thing that really helps me and sort of hits me more emotionally is that we have like 10 trillion cells in our body. We call ourselves a human being, and 9 trillion of those 10 trillion don't have any human DNA. They have their own DNA. So they're like, you know, we are only actually 10% human, you know. But we really grasp from that the idea that we're a human being, and actually we're a community of like hundreds of billions of bacteria, you know, parasites, and, you know, all these things. You know,
it's helpful to be born in this age because we've got electron microscopes. And when we take thermoses and people and we look at them and under electron microscopes, it's mostly empty space. Mm-hmm. And so that gives some. I felt a little unnerved earlier today when you went through all of that. I was like, man, it, you know, you get to a place where all of a sudden you're feeling a little edgy about that.
That's good. It means it's having an effect.
You know, but certainly living now in 2015 as opposed to living in like 1015.
Yeah.
There, you know, at least there's some things you can look at and go, all right.
Yeah. Let's close here.
May the spiritual teacher soon lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lobsang's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the 3 worlds always increase.
Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Purana, and be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May the born have no divine but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Shinrezi, may you stay until samsara ends. May
seat of explaining and practicing the Dharma, down by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially Atravasti Abhi in the